Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're done with your Oreo?
Yeah, done with my Oreo.
Okay, good. Do we really know what happened? The brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too!
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah, I mean, that's
a murdery thingy.
I'm super relaxed. I'm ready to...
Yeah, this is like this is going to be a more relaxed episode, I think.
I want to hear your story.
I want to hear the rest of your story, because you left us on a huge cliffhanger last time.
Okay.
Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy.
Oh, yes, yes. Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy. My name is Chloe.
Where we talk about mysteries and Chloe's. My name's Mario.
We talk about mysteries.
We talk about, honestly, whatever the fuck we want to talk about.
Mysteries and murderies and thingies,
right.
And this one's a mystery. This one's a mystery.
Mine is also a mystery. A murder mystery.
So it's murder.
A double murder mystery. And it's also a political assassination.
Cuckoo,
so,
cuckoo, no doubt.
And so let's
do a quick rewind into a quick summary. So just a little quick refresh.
Oh, were you going first?
You said you wanted to hear it.
Oh, when we talked about it, like literally 5 minutes ago, you were literally like, Mario, you go first. Like just before we started recording,
I was like,
"We should go first." You're like,
"But
you."
Then I thought we had like an agreement.
I'm
like
sorry.
When you literally said, "I want to hear it."
Okay, we'll go. I do.
Oh, should I go? Should I go?
Yeah, okay. You go first. You go first.
Okay,
I'm glad it worked out this way.
So I'm talking about Treva Thronberry,
right?
A 16-year-old girl who went missing in Electra, Texas. A small tiny town. She's a pretty normal girl, loves her Bible and her tennis racket. And then I started also talking about a girl who called herself Brianna Stewart and was also had a lot of stories to tell, such as her father raping her or being in a satanic cult and things such as that.
It should be pointed out things that didn't seem like they were true in her particular instance.
Yes. Brianna Stewart also liked to carry tennis rackets and Bibles as well. Just going to put that out there. Okay. We're starting off with the many identities of Brianna Stewart. So, the pattern begins in 1993 in the little town of Corvallis, Oregon. There was a teenager named Kelly T. Thronberry. Kelly T. Thronberry Smith, working at a McDonald's and staying with a family that she had met at a church. She told people that she preferred the name Kaylee Smith, even went to court in Corvallis to change her name legally to Kaylee Smith because... apparently she was hiding from her father who lived in Dallas, and I guess she told officers that one time he had found her and he forced her into his car and raped her. That's what she told officers. But the police could never find Kaylee's father, and then eventually Kaylee Smith disappeared. The next summer, she surfaced in Portland, telling the police there that she was on the run from her sexually abusive father, a Portland police officer. She said, my dad's a Portland police officer and he's sexually abusing me and I'm on the run. There was an investigation opened, but Kaylee disappeared again. In the summer of 1994, in a town of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, she popped up. She told the police that her name was Carolina Davis and that her mother had been murdered and her father, a police officer, had raped her repeatedly as a child because he was in a satanic cult. Disappeared from Coeur d'Alene about 2 months later. She arrived in Plano, Texas, and told officers and social workers there that her name was Carol Williams, that she was 16 years old, and that she had been born and raised in a satanic cult. See some patterns here, right? Yeah. Similar things as before. She said her mother was murdered. She said her father was the cult leader who had raped her many times as a child, and worked as a police officer as well in Coleyville, which is another town in Texas.
So many patterns, but I think I was also just kind of, like, remembering, like, this whole satanic cult thing seems so out of left field, but in the early 90s, we were seeing the second wave of the satanic panic, right? Mm-hmm. This was the resurgence of the satanic panic hardcore for many years in the 90s into the 2000s, so it was definitely in the zeitgeist, and, like,
for sure.
If she's, I could see where, you know, like, assuming that no, that it's not true, right, that she's making it up, which it seems like she is, that it's a convenient story because it's something people are primed to believe at the time. So, yeah. Anyway, that was just the thought I was having while you were talking.
No, that's true. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. One female detective even drove to Coleyville and asked the police chief if he knew any officer who was kind of into Satan, you know. One time, a volunteer for a social work agency took it upon herself to give Kara some exposure. She took her shopping and even went to a trip to Six Flags. Social workers moved her from shelter to shelter, trying to find a place where she would feel safe. At one shelter, she accused one of the male workers of sexually molesting her, which led her to be moved again. With each move, she was enrolled in a new high school. In the spring of 1995 alone, Kara attended high schools in Sadler, Sherman, and Dallas, Texas. And in each high school, she joined the tennis team. Suzanne Arnold, the Child Protective Services worker who was supervising Kara's case, she bought her a new tennis racket as a gift. To help her confidence in her skill. In September of 1995, Suzanne Arnold received a call from someone at the residential treatment center where Kara was staying. The person who was calling her happened to be from the little town of Electra, Texas, and said, quote, "Suzanne, I think Kara is actually a 26-year-old woman named Treva Throneberry," end quote.
What?
Boom. So, the girl who called herself Carol Williams refused to speak, even when she was confronted with records, with photographs. They had handwriting samples. They had everything to prove her identity. But this is what I find so fascinating. Either she really, truly believed that she was this person, or she's a really, really good actress, because she still had a whole amount of people on her side who were like, how dare you treat this like mistreated girl who's already suffered so much abuse and this, that, and the other thing. But then it also makes me question, like, there's definitely abuse there somewhere.
And you said that there was documented abuse in the last episode from her uncle, right?
Those were what the sisters were saying.
Right. Documented in the sense that, yeah, her sisters were also, like, backing up that story.
Yes.
Whereas, and again, this last episode, like, go back and listen to the first half, when she was accusing her dad, they didn't back her up. So, like, they seemed to have some credibility, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but like you said, clearly there's, like, something where it's coming from somewhere.
Yeah. She was so adamant and so tearful and so broken, you know, and upset that she had a whole team on her side. After a court hearing discharged her from government supervision, she continued to maintain her identity as Carol Williams, and she disappeared again. In June of 1996, a 16-year-old teenager named Emily Carol Williams arrived in Asheville, North Carolina, where she told police officers she was on the run from a cult in Texas. In August 1996, a 16-year-old girl named Stephanie Williams came to Altoona, Pennsylvania, where she told the police she was on the run from her father back in Memphis, Tennessee, who was involved in a cult and also was the head of a child pornography ring. a social worker spotted Suzanne Arnold's name, one of her supervisors, in the girl's notebook. And so at that point, you know, some phone calls and record checks proved that the girl was Trevor Thornberry. She was arrested and sent to jail for 9 days for providing a false report to law enforcement. At one point, an Altoona social worker called Carl and Patsy, her, like, her actual parents, and asked them to speak to their daughter to remind her who she was. So she was, after those 9 days, you know, she was eventually released from Altoona jail, and she goes on the road again, showing up in, quote, Louisiana, New Jersey, and Ohio, where she'd show up at youth shelters carrying some luggage, a teddy bear, a Bible, a flute with sheet music, and algebra homework, end quote.
Where did she get the algebra homework?
I forgot to mention that. She was super into algebra. She wasn't great at it, but she really liked it. And every single, like, time she went to high school and every single class she loved was algebra.
Such a weird
existence. I can't remember if she loved it or she hated it. I think she loved it.
She was enthralled by it in a love-hate relationship.
She wasn't great at it.
She had a complicated relationship.
She wasn't good at tennis either. Sorry.
She was good at pretending she was other people. Is that a skill?
Or is she pretending? Like, that's the question.
Oh, right, sure. That's, like, part of the that's, like, the mystery. Sure, sure.
So, right. She keeps doing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
She kind of found that high school was her safe place, her refuge, right?
Sure.
So here's a quote from the main article that I got. Quote, why? Why had Trevor Thornberry used at least 18 teenage aliases since the early 90s, and why had she spun such gruesomely outlandish tales? Was she nothing more than a con artist pretending to be a downtrodden teenager to receive free foster care and free education? Was she afflicted with what doctors call psychiatric Munchausen syndrome, in which she intentionally feigned intense emotional distress to receive extra attention? Or was she slowly descending into an irreparable insanity, the likes of which no one had ever seen before? Was it indeed possible that by the time she entered Evergreen High School in 1997, she had completely forgotten the girl she had once been in 1985? End quote.
Wow.
So there's a lot
it's a good quote.
To think about that. I know. Yeah. I was like, I can't summarize this in my own words.
Right. Like, these words are better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to the arrest in March of 2001.
Okay. Flash forward.
For perjury and theft.
Uh-huh.
The detective explained that, so now it's 2001, that she was a 31-year-old woman and that she had fraudulently received free foster care and free public education from the state of Washington. And the proof was the fingerprints that they had taken earlier. So they matched those of a woman from Altoona, Pennsylvania, by the name of Trevor Thornberry. And I don't know if I said this earlier, but she got, I don't know if this is still in the story or not. I talked about two lawyers. She hired a lawyer from, like, Portland and then a lawyer from Vancouver, and she didn't tell them what they were doing.
Right, you mentioned that in the last episode,
but,
yeah.
To get her, because she was trying to get her Social Security number.
Right.
And one of them said, let me take your fingerprints.
Oh, okay.
Just to make sure you're not somebody else.
Right.
And she said, okay.
Which to me, the fact that she assented to that, and obviously we don't really know the circumstance, right? But you'd think that if she weren't, you know, if this were a conscious con, that she would throw up some resistance to that. Like, obviously, that's going to come back to bite you.
Right.
So, I mean, who knows? But, yeah, that's definitely, like, to take into consideration.
It's wild. So the proof, the fingerprints ended up being part of proof. And word about her arrest spread really quickly. Some people wanted her to get help. You know, psychiatric help instead of being sent to prison. Michael Kinney, the Clark County senior deputy prosecutor, argued that Trevor needed to be treated as a common criminal. He said that she knew exactly what she was doing, and she was a malicious liar, and she was dangerous. note that the security guard that she falsely reported for rape had actually served time in prison. But once her, you know, she was found out, it was expunged.
Hmm.
So there was still more support for, there was still support on Trevor's side, though, when her sisters came out to the public about the abuse that they all suffered with their uncle.
Mm-hmm.
One of Trevor's attorneys pointed out that if she was an evil con artist, she would have picked, wouldn't she have picked a more glamorous life than being a homeless teenager?
Hmm.
You know?
Right. I mean, like, this, I don't remember her name, but there was, like, that woman recently, right, found out, who was, like, pretending to be some heiress, European heiress,
oh,
right?
Oh, my girl. Oh.
I can't remember her name. But, like, clearly she was a con artist who was, like, conning people out of money by pretending she was rich. Like, there was no, like, gray area where it's like, oh, well, is she, like, sick or, like, mentally ill? Like, no, she was a con artist.
Oh my
but
God.
This is so, so gray.
The fact that I can't think of her name right now is killing me.
We'll look it up later. It's fine.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I heard it recently, but I can't remember either.
So, and he also argues, quote, this case is not about fraud, but about a tremendous emptiness and need, a trauma very early in her life, end quote. The greatest mystery about the story was why Trevor Thornberry still refused to admit who she was. She never, ever cracked. She had been caught in Plano, Texas in 1995. She had been caught in Altoona, Pennsylvania in 96, and now Vancouver, Washington in 01. She declared in letters and in interviews that she had never even heard of Trevor Thornberry. When her niece, Jaleesha, wrote her, she says that Trevor responded with a letter for Owen, quote, Dear Jaleesha Thornberry, I'm sorry to tell you this. I don't know who you are, end quote. In court, she went ahead and played as her own defense attorney, as is her right.
Sure.
She had fired her court-appointed attorneys when she found out that they were planning on arguing that she was Trevor Thornberry, but didn't know she was committing a crime because she truly believed she was Brianna Stewart. The prosecutor, Michael Kinney, brought in, so he's the one who's like, she is a criminal, brought in...
Hard ass.
Yes. Brought in Sharon Gentry, Trevor's foster mom from 15 years ago.
Mm. The one whose husband was accused, apparently falsely, by Trevor at the time, if I recall correctly. Right?
No, it was her. She accused her own father, Carl.
But I thought she also accused the foster father of something.
Maybe that's why she got kicked out.
I think so. I'm pretty sure.
I think you're right.
Right?
I think you're right.
Okay. We can all go back and check.
We can all go back and check.
Anyway, please go on.
And so she testified that she had known Trevor when she was 15 years old, and then she brought in photos as proof.
Mm-hmm.
And people still talk about this it being like a very heartbreaking moment of the trial that Sharon Gentry was kind of an unexpected witness, you mm-hmm. know? Trevor walked up to the stand and said, quote, this Trevor in these pictures, what was she like? And Gentry said, quote, she was a very polite young lady. She enjoyed church. She enjoyed tennis. She had a wooden tennis racket. She was always very appropriate, very thankful. She always apologized if she hurt my feelings, end quote. And then Trevor says, was Trevor smart? Gentry says, oh, yes, she loved to read and really enjoyed school activities. She made good grades. Trevor, did she work hard? Gentry, she worked very hard. She tried hard. Trevor was a wonderful young woman. And then she replies, oh, thank you. And then, like, dismisses her. Yeah.
That's just bizarre. It's like, so you think I'm this person and now I'm asking you questions. Oh, like... if someone wrote that into a Law and Order episode, I'd think it was too ridiculous to be real. Like, that's so crazy.
Trevor Brianna, I'll call her at the moment, didn't provide much evidence to counter Kinney's arguments in general. She brought up friends and teachers who knew her and to testify on her behalf that all she wanted was a social security number and to get on with her life. That's all she wanted. So, the verdict. The jury found Treva Thornberry guilty, and the judge sentenced her to 3 years in prison. The judge wished, so at first he did want to send her to a hospital for treatment, mm-hmm. but prison was the only legal option because Washington State had very little options for mental health services for inmates. So it was really the only option.
As is so often the case in America.
Yeah, yeah. Her attorney, Jerry Ware, said, there's no question in my mind, having spent as much time with her as I have, that she is of the opinion that she is Breonna Stewart, end quote. So some theories to go over. The mystery that psychologists, social workers, and psychiatrists, and anybody on the medical side of things looks into this case. They argue about how much Treva actually remembered about her past. Some argued her past abuse from her uncle had been like a physical trauma disconnecting memories in her brain. One professor of psychology said the abuse could have set off what is known as a dissociative fugue, a type of amnesia in which she didn't know how she got where she was or why she was there. Others suggested she could have had multiple personality disorder. So, you know, she created lots of these other personalities to deal with the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
A psychologist who had actually examined her for several days in Texas in 1995 was intrigued by her sincerity when she talked of satanic rituals and gang rape. He wrote in his report, quote, "There was nothing in her behavior or presentation to suggest that she was knowingly misrepresenting the facts," end quote. Mm-hmm. Also, why did she give the attorney from Portland her fingerprints? And she also demanded that DNA tests be done against her parents. And the test result was that it was a 99.93% chance that she was the daughter of Carl and Patsy. Kenneth Muscatel, a psychologist from Seattle who was hired to examine Treva, said, quote, "If it is what people think, a woman needing to go back to a certain age and relive it again and again, then it would be one for the books. Here is a woman who invents stories to get love and affection she had never known in her home, yet a woman so profoundly disturbed that she ends up turning on the very people who were trying to help her, accusing them of abuse," end quote. Treva Thornberry was eventually released from jail. The last time she was heard of was in 2016 in Lacey, Washington. And I found like an original article about the incident. Mm-hmm. It was reported in The Olympian. Suspect in hotel assault cleared of charges. The article talks about a hotel employee by the name of Breonna Kenzie, who had been working the night shift and, quote, said an unknown man snuck up behind her, held her up against the building, and attempted to spread her legs with his knee. She told police she hit the man in the head with a flashlight, end quote. The man who was accused, this guy named Michael Caton, ended up getting arrested. And his story was that this woman was trying to steal his meth, and he pushed her, and then she punched him in the nose. So then they start looking at her criminal past, and they saw why she had gone to jail for 3 years. And so she was fired.
Hmm.
And that's...
they found out she was actually Treva Thornberry.
The end of that.
Yeah. I can't believe she used 18 aliases over a year or 2 years. Like... or several years, I guess.
I think 1995 to 2001.
That's just... yeah, I just can't imagine that. It's just crazy.
What do you think?
I guess, fall more on the side of it being some kind of... that she was less aware of it than more aware of it. She didn't seem like a criminal. Like, what she was doing technically was criminal, but she didn't seem conscious of it. I don't know. What do you think?
I think the same.
Yeah.
I think if I could put it into like a percentage, she's like 75% believes that she is Brianna Stewart and 25%, you know, aware. I don't know. Right. I feel like she always disappeared at the right times. So it's like people are trying to help her and then she's gets up and leaves.
What I'm wondering, I guess partly too, and obviously like neither of us is a psychologist, like we don't really know anything about these things, but if you have multiple personality disorder, at least the way it's portrayed in media, like movies and stuff, is that one personality can be aware of things that another personality is not aware of.
What?
So maybe there's a personality that's like sort of like takes over, and then it's like she transitions into like the new personality after that. And just, like, wakes up in a new town and it's like, I'm this person, and truly believes it. Because, like, the pathology is that that's what's happening, right? Who knows? Again, I don't really know, but I think that's possible. Perhaps, maybe. I don't know.
My mind is blown.
Or maybe she was aware of it the whole time and she just really wanted to stay in high school into her 30s. I don't know.
It's a good story.
It's a good mystery. And it's an interesting mystery because it's, like, not an obvious, right? It's not, like, because she obviously did all these things, but why? That's the mystery.
Yeah,
it's a good one. I like it.
It's why, and it's also, like...
Did you say your sources?
Is she aware? Crap. Well, now it's going to take a second for my laptop to start back up. That's okay. Because she's well-loved.
You know, we said at the beginning this can be a little bit of a relaxed episode, so that's fine.
A relaxed... episode. Why don't we all do sources at the end?
Okay.
I had a really nice long form. Oh, here it is. I had a really nice long form article.
Me too.
Oh my God. I didn't write it down.
That's okay.
We'll talk about it after.
Okay. So I'll jump into my mystery for this week. And like I said, it's a murder mystery and it's another assassination.
Murder.
And it is the murder of Robert and Jean Cora Smit. Which is funny that you said one of her aliases was Smit.
Yeah.
Like not Smith, but Smit.
Yeah.
And that's their name as well. So it's kind of that's a weird funny. Coincidence. But anyway. So in 1977, Dr. Robert Smit was a young, up-and-coming politician, in the very much globally ostracized apartheid-era South African government, right? The Afrikaner government, as it is known. And if, you know, just, a little bit, the apartheid government, apartheid in South Africa was generally from the mid-40s to the early to mid-90s. And Robert Smit had served in stints in the Afrikaner government, but also in business, including his most recent assignment at this time, the ambassador to the International Monetary Fund in New York City. The International Monetary Fund being a global sort of intergovernmental agency that makes large loans to nations, like for development.
Okay, that's kind of nuts.
Yeah, it's like the IMF and the World Bank. They're like the two main ones that do that sort of thing. So Robert Smit was also rumored to be the next Treasury Secretary for South Africa. So mm-hmm. he was like, you know, about to be real big. But he would end up being, along with his wife Jean Cora, found dead on November 22nd of 1977. And the crime remains a baffling mystery up until now. And one of my sources, again, one of those good, they phrased it better than I could, mm-hmm. described it like this, quote, "Researching the case means slowly making one's way through this fog of disinformation and denial. Mm-hmm. Trying to get the truth over three decades on is like trying to hit from a great distance one blurred and fleeting target among many," close quote.
Oh, God.
So, again, as with all of ours, right, it's a mystery. But just a little context first. South Africa, like I said, at this time existed in a sort of wholly racially segregated society, right? An apartheid, which is I forget what language it's from, but I think it's Afrikaans, meaning apartness. And of course, this is something that's existed in America for a long time, in other countries, but apartheid itself comes from the South African context specifically. So the white descendants of, you know, Dutch, English occupiers of South Africa were referred to as the Afrikaner. And as with many children of these white settlers, Robert Smith went back to England for his higher education, or at least in part. So he went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. And unlike most of those children, he went on to get a doctorate in economics and serve also as the deputy secretary of finance by the time he was, like, in his mid-30s. So this guy, when I said up and coming, yeah, he was, like, rocket. So after his time at the IMF, which ended on Halloween Day, 1974, Robert Smith returned to South Africa to stand for election, as they call it, right? For the National Party, which is the, I think at the time, the biggest party in South Africa, from his hometown of Springs, South Africa. The election was held on November 30th, 1974, about a week after he was killed. 77. I don't know why I wrote 74. In the weeks leading up to his killing, Robert Smith had been really busy. He had just come back to the country, like I said, preparing for the upcoming election. He and his wife, Jean Cora, had just rented a new house in Springs, leaving their children at their second home in Pretoria.
Oh, how nice.
I know, right? Well, like I said, he was like going to be the finance minister, right? I mean, he wasn't as rich as Steve Mnuchin, I'm sure, but still pretty rich, I'm sure.
I don't know Steve Mnuchin. That is.
No, he's the Treasury Secretary for the United States.
Okay.
And he's real rich, like many people in this administration. But anyway, that's like a whole other tangent that I don't need to get into. On the morning of November 22nd, the day of the crime, Robert went into work as usual at his election office. At 3:15 p.m. that day, according to his receptionist, Sarah Lombard, Smith received a call from a mysterious man calling himself McDougal. Weird. Who wanted to, quote, talk about politics with Robert. She patched the call through, and according to his diary, Robert made arrangements to meet this mysterious, quote-unquote, McDougal at 8 p.m. that night.
What? Whose idea is this?
I know, right? So this is setting up like a Agatha Christie mystery, right? Meanwhile, Jean Court.
Agatha Christie, her death is a mystery, too.
Is it? I didn't.
She, like, straight up disappeared.
Ooh. We'll have to do that one.
Anyway.
Maybe soon. Meanwhile, Jean Cora had been, Robert Smith's wife, had been driven home by their driver, Daniel Tshabalala. Sorry. I practiced that one, too.
I know you did.
It's tough.
Because I heard you.
I know, right? Tshabalala. Or something. Anyway, sorry, Daniel. The couple's driver, he testified at the inquest that he left Mrs. Smith alone in her home at 6:50 p.m. that night, and she locked the door behind him. Sometime between 7:15 p.m. and 7:45, Jean Cora called Dr. Smith's office and told him that, quote, his guests are waiting for him. Don't know what that means exactly.
That's creepy.
Based on the forensic analysis of the crime scene, it appears that Jean Cora was shot just after hanging up from this call.
Yeah. How do they know that?
Because she was slumped over the table where the phone was, with her arm outstretched.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So apparently it was kind of obvious. In the lounge of their home, Robert, not knowing this, of course, promptly left his office and was seen driving away just before 8 p.m., when he arrived home, he was, quote, shot in the neck from a few paces away, close quote, immediately. It appears that the killer then walked up to the body and shot Robert at close range again, three more times, in the chest, in the back, in the head.
Oh, God, that's so fucked up.
Just to make sure, right? Ballistics indicated that two weapons were used, as Robert and Jean Cora were shot with different calibers of bullets. And as with many aspects of this case, the exact timeline here is somewhat mysterious because a neighbor claimed to have heard gunshots at 11:15 p.m., but it appeared that they were shot earlier than that. So everything about this case, it's just a little bit unclear. But in any case, at 7 a.m. the next morning, Daniel, the Smith's driver, arrived and found the bodies of his now former employees, employers. Robert's body was found in the foyer. Jean Cora is, like I said, in the lounge, slumped over the phone.
I thought he was driving.
Well, when Robert got home, he was shot. And then
when he got home, okay.
And then they may have also dragged his body kind of further into the house. It's not totally clear. So investigators also discovered that Robert, in addition to being shot multiple times, had been stabbed.
What?
14 times.
What? Why? Do they know which one happened first?
I mean, it seems like the knife probably after the gunshots, I'd imagine. But the stabbings were definitely post-mortem. They do know that.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah, and apparently it was done with this, it seems, this kind of knife called a stiletto, which is a very long, slender-bladed knife.
Oh, like a shoe?
Well, that's what the shoe's named after, yeah.
Oh.
And apparently this kind of, like, stiletto, it's like, meant for stabbing.
Oh, it's meant for, that's nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's like a, you know, like an assassin's weapon, I guess, kind of. I'm not sure. So, very cryptically also, the letters, quote, R-A-U-T-E-M, kind of like R-A-U is one block, T-E-M is another block, in big, bold letters, had been spray painted in red across the fridge and the kitchen walls.
What?
And it's really not clear if what this has to do with anything or if it does have to do with anything.
It had to be political.
One of my main sources thought that this whole thing with the spray paint and everything may have been kind of a red herring to make the killing look like the work of a sort of deranged lunatic. But instead, like you're saying, it was political. It was like a hit job, right? Because that's like what most things are pointing to. But this whole thing with the spray paint and whatever, like it's not clear that that has anything to do with anything necessarily. Another of the lingering mysteries that were kind of baffling investigators at this time was the true identity of the so-called McDougal, right, that had called Smith's office earlier in the day, that he had written in his diary he was to meet at, you know, almost the precise time of his death.
Oh, my God.
Reportedly, this McDougal sort of moniker was a pseudonym that Smith had used with friends since college. If that has anything, again, to do with anything, it's not clear. Apparently, Robert Smith had also told different people that he was going to have a meeting that night. And it wasn't totally clear who was going to be with. To some people, he seemed to tell it was like with opposition voters, like opposition of the National Party voters. And other people, he told that it was just like undesirable people, like people he didn't want to meet with, but he had to. So not clear who that would be. Another mystery is why would anyone want to kill Robert Smith, right? What is the motive here? Political, sure, but particularly. And we do have some ideas of what that might be, actually very definite ideas of what that might be. The theory that came up the most, definitely, and seemed the most substantiated in my research was that Robert Smith had uncovered some kind of malfeasance being perpetrated by sort of higher-ups in the Afrikaner government, misappropriation of funds.
Why are you smiling at me like that?
It's just like the, I don't know, whenever I'm reading about this, people use so many different, what's it called? They don't say what they mean. They call it something else, right?
Oh, euphemisms.
Euphemisms, exactly. Because you can't just say, I guess, like, oh, this person in government stole a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
You have to say, like, it was a misappropriation of funds or whatever, right?
Something you can type in an email.
Right. But essentially, he found out, apparently, allegedly, that people in the government in South Africa, and this happens in a lot of different governments, were funneling money not to where they're supposed to go, but to, like, Swiss bank accounts. Like, literally Swiss bank accounts. And accounts in America. The thinking is he sort of uncovered this. And by all accounts, Robert was a straight shooter. If one who was willing to work for a completely racist government, of course. You always have to remember that. But Robert may have been tipped off when he was kind of lobbying for loans for South Africa, right, at the IMF as the ambassador, when he was told by some American friends that, why does South Africa need loans? You have all this money in American accounts, $70 million. Like, he had friends in the banks, right, who knew this. And they were like, your government has $70 million sitting in bank accounts in America. Like, why do you need a loan? And he's like, what do you mean $70 million sitting in bank accounts in America? He didn't know about it. No one knew about it. They were secret. This was money that had been stolen. Like, this is what he was kind of uncovering, right? He came to find out.
Oh, that's weird.
Which has got to be pretty crazy from his end, right?
So somebody accidentally spilled the beans?
Exactly. They accidentally spilled the beans. Because they, I guess, didn't know it was, like, whatever. That the South African people
didn't
know.
That's kind of, I feel like I would add that into a comedy. Like,
right. It is kind of a comedic situation. In
yeah.
A way.
So what are you talking about? We got 70 million in the banks.
Right. So yeah, there were all these undeclared funds. And this was, you know, a sign of kind of a larger problem. Robert also discovered the names of at least 20 U.S. politicians who were being paid off by the South African government.
No!
Including senators.
No!
Yeah. And there's this whole weird shit at the time, apparently, between, like, the Chilean government right under Pinochet and the South African government with the Afrikaners and the CIA. And it's just, like, a whole mess of weird shit going on. Yeah, I might get into some more of that in a future episode. I think I'm gonna buy a book on Operation Condor soon. So look forward to that. So many press reports at the time of Robert Smith's death, in other words, hinted at some kind of illegal financial scheme, right? Using all of these euphemisms that Robert was about to uncover when he was killed. So clearly a motive is emerging here, right? According to a friend of Robert's as well, Emerantia Liebenberg, speaking to the Sunday Times, quote, Robert Smith had told her that he had decided to approach a senior cabinet minister about a matter that would rock the nation and go right to the top, close quote. People at the very top of the government, in other words, involved in this financial malfeasance. Members of Robert's campaign, his campaign for the parliament in South Africa, also indicated that he had told them that he would, like, expose something, right, really big. Like, he didn't want to say what it was, but he was like, something's coming. Like, once I get elected, like, just prepare, because I'm gonna, like, rock the shit.
Rock the boat.
Is that a phrase? That's not a phrase.
It's rock the boat.
I'm gonna rock the boat hard, and it's gonna have some shit in it. No, not good. Oh, sorry.
Tip the oar over. I think that's what it is. It's like a softball chant.
Don't rock the boat, baby.
Yeah.
Don't tip the boat over.
That's exactly what it is.
Right. His brother, Robert's brother, Ian Smith, had also indicated that Robert had told him of unspecified political wrongdoings and that Robert would soon expose them in a visit that...
Why is he telling people...
I know. Well, because it was big, you know, and he was excited about it, right? I mean, he wanted to be, you know, the good guy, right?
Yeah, you're about to, like, I understand.
Yeah, and if we needed any further substantiation, right, in fact, there was a financial scandal, a huge financial scandal that was exposed soon after Robert Smith and Jean Cora's death. Which did, in fact, involve the prime minister, one of the leaders of the National Party, and the chief of the Bureau for State Security, known as BOSS.
Wow.
And it did not, of course, escape the notice of people at the time, that or afterwards, that there was this huge political scandal just after the Smiths were murdered, possibly because they were about to expose a huge political scandal. Yeah. Right? Like, again, clearly this is what's going on.
Sounds familiar to what's happening right now, does it not?
Perhaps. In other words, suspicions fell heavily on those government officials involved in the financial malfeasance. I just love saying the word malfeasance. I'm sorry. I've said it like 8 times. Obviously, none of these suspicions was ever proved, right? Because it's a mystery. That's why I'm fucking talking about it. But a sense has pervaded since that this was a hit carried out by the Afrikaner government, that it was political, as you were saying earlier. This apparently shocked the conscience
of
the...
We don't know any gunmen?
What's that?
We don't know any gunmen?
I don't know any gunmen. Despite being from Texas, this whole thing with Robert Smith being killed, maybe by the government, right, apparently shocked the conscience of the nation. Although again, it's a bit discordant thinking about the fact that they were living in, you know, where a country that was just routinely murdering and worse black people throughout the whole nation the whole time. That's just always a little discordant with me when I'm reading about stuff from the apartheid era that doesn't talk about that. Which is like, it's just swept under the rug for like all this time. Anyway, it's just crazy. So anyway, fast forward to the apartheid, to after the apartheid regime that perpetuated that racial terror, you know, that we were talking about. So this is kind of like the mid-90s and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that followed that. And that commission, unlike with some other cases, did not reveal the truth about what happened with the Smith murders. People thought it was going to, but it didn't end up coming out through that. Huh. Like some other high-profile crimes were solved that way, or more or less, right? But it did reveal some more information. So in 1997, Roy Allen, although he was only called R.A. in the official documents, a former member of the security police, was named as the chief suspect in the case. Allen had been dating Robert Smith's secretary at the time he was killed, and the two had been briefly acquainted. Now, Roy Allen suggested that the Smiths were probably probably murdered by a foreign hit squad, perhaps at the direction of the government. So he said, it's not the security service, I wasn't involved, but I'm not saying it couldn't have been the South African government, but if it was the South African government, then it was probably a foreign hit squad, not a domestic hit squad. Just saying, right?
Yeah.
Nevertheless, a 2006 report in the publication Bild cited high-level intelligence sources claiming that the Smiths had been murdered by three members of the security police. Dries Verwey, Phil Freeman, who had used the Mr. McDougal pseudonym in the 80s, and Roy Allen.
I thought you said you didn't have any gunmen.
Oh, I thought you meant in real life. Yeah, no, there are a few. There's one more name that'll arise. Sorry, I didn't realize what you meant. Sorry. I didn't get it. A 2009 report linked a man named Talifer Ty Minar, an associate of Allen and Freeman, to the killings, even claiming that he had repented for the crime in later years, saying that,
what?
Quote, his orders had come from the very top, but that he now regretted the whole dirty business, close quote. Now, that's hearsay, right? So
it's not, like, reported?
I mean, it's reported that someone told a reporter that he told them that. So it's hearsay.
I can't even follow that chain.
It's third hand information. And to us, to the listeners, it's fourth hand information. So take it as you will. Minar had a mysterious past, including working alongside the CIA in Cuba in the mid 1970s before returning to South Africa. Another theory called the quote-unquote lost theory by my source James Myberg, which was kind of my main source, goes like this. Okay, Myberg claims that this theory mysteriously fell out of the public consciousness soon after it arose, but the idea is that it had something to do with a foreign hit squad, like Ray Allen suggested, and particularly that it was the Cuban nationalist movement and the CIA that may have been involved with this as well.
Why is this so deep?
I know it runs pretty deep. This one's like a really, really mysterious case. So as has been extensively documented, there were extensive ties between the CIA and the Cuban nationalist movement in exile in the 70s and 80s. I mean, I talked about that in the last episode about Johnny Roselli, right?
Yeah.
There were also a lot of connections between the security services of South Africa, Chile, and the United States at the time, as we mentioned earlier. It may be that through these connections, the South African government hired the hitmen, i.e. the Cuban exiles, who carried out the Smith murders, as Chile had allegedly used such hitmen to carry out various hits in different countries around the same time with a similar M.O., And it was also suggested that the Chilean secret security services may have actually done surveillance for the operation, and then the Cuban exiles came in after them and did the hit themselves. All, of course, overseen by the South African security services to make sure everything was going smoothly. So there may actually have been three different entities involved in this. It runs deep.
This is wild.
And wide. It's crazy. Allegedly, all of this is purely speculation.
This is badass.
Right.
I mean, no, it's terrible. It's fucking, it is terrible. But I wouldn't mind seeing. I would not mind seeing an action movie based on it.
It should be a movie. Maybe it has been. I don't know. Keeping in mind, of course, always that Robert and Jean Corbett Smith were people who didn't deserve to die. Like, I don't want to in any way, like, glamorize their death or anything.
It's pretty, it's fucked
like
up.
That. I mean, they died in a very gruesome way that no one fucking deserves. But
to me, what got me when you started talking about that is the, like, you don't even have time to process that you've been shot. You're just immediately dead. Like, what?
Right.
Too much for me.
But again, it seems too like much. A hit, right? It seemed
the
like
gunshots,
a professional hit.
The stabbing was weird.
Yeah, that part of it is really weird. I don't know what, honestly, I don't know what to make of that at all. So another, one more hitman, one more name. The trigger man in this theory, the Lost theory, at least one of them, would have allegedly be a man sometimes known as Virgilio Paz, a young operations man from the Cuban nationalist movement, according to one of my sources. An anonymous source also claimed that, claimed decades later that he was actually the driver, the anonymous source was the driver, and he actually ID'd Paz as one of the hit team, along with four other people. Other names connected to the Cubans were thrown around, but they all had a pretty plausible, like, including some of the people that guy named, alibi for the time, but not Paz. His whereabouts were documented before and after November 22nd of 1977, but not, like, that week. So it's, like, possible. He could have been there. So anyway, absent a sort of dramatic revelation, right, which seems, like, pretty unlikely, this case is probably going to stay a big morass of mysteries. The South African authorities have nominally kept the case open all these years, but the investigation doesn't seem like it's really going to go anywhere. So, according to James Myberg, the local authorities also have essentially ignored the possibility of foreign involvement, so they're not even really looking into that at all as a possibility. He also believes that if there was foreign involvement, that there is much more to reveal, since that kind of large-scale operation, like we were talking about, like others committed as part of Operation Condor, would have involved many different entities from different countries. Like, there would just be so many more parties involved. And how did...
One person's death?
Well, in two people's death, but...
Or, of course.
Furthermore, Myberg highlights that while it's almost assumed that Robert and Jean Cora Smith were murdered because of their financial, you know, misdeeds uncovered by Robert, right? We don't know that. We don't know what was going on. We don't know what the real motive was. So while it seems obvious that it is a political hit job, really, we have no idea at all.
Do you think this one will ever be solved?
I think it will, because it'll come out, somebody's, like, child or grandchild will say they confessed to them or something. But it'll be, like, the other big mysteries, we won't believe it. Like, will it ever be solved to everyone's satisfaction? No. But the Lincoln assassination isn't solved to everyone's satisfaction. Like, these things just, like, persist. But it for now, it is extremely mysterious. So like I said, James Myberg was my main source writing at politicsweb.co.za, and also an article by Nick Dahl at OZOZY.com, Karen Dolly at IOL, and of course, Wikipedia.
My main source was a long form article by Skip Hollinsworth in Texas Monthly.
I've read many articles by Skip Hollinsworth. He's a great writer.
It's good. It's called, The Day Trevor Thornberry Disappeared. So, yeah.
He's want to write long-form articles.
It's really
good.
He's
an excellent writer.
And then my other source is the news article in The Olympian by Andy Hobbs the 2016 news article when, like, the story of this guy being cleared on assault charges and the accuser was fucking Trevor Thornberry. The fuck?
Yeah, that's crazy. Okay, let's do some
weird shit in the news. Ah.
Weird. I'll go first, I guess. So I just wanted you let you guys know, someone left old TVs outside 50 homes in Virginia while wearing a TV on his head. No one knows why. That's the that's the headline of this article by Hannah Nattanson.
How high is this guy?
Oh my god. There is video, because of course there's video, it's 2019. And from Ring Doorbells, and you should go and look at it. But yeah, at least one person, and maybe two, left more than 50 old TVs sitting on the stoops of different homes in Henrico County, Virginia. Very early or late, I guess, depending on how you think about it, one night recently, and they were all just sitting there peacefully facing the door. They were all the same, and no one was hurt. Some people were amused. Others were slightly disturbed. No one knows what the fuck is going on or why anyone did this or who it was. And honestly, it doesn't seem like anyone is that interested in finding out. But, yeah, just very weird.
That is too much for me.
Hey, none of them was a bomb, so I think it's great. Because
that's
that was
true.
If I saw a fucking TV sitting on my stoop and I didn't know why it was there, I'm sorry, in this day and age, I'd think it was a bomb.
There is a
But it wasn't, great, just to be clear.
There was a great video of a woman in the she films it after she finds out, but she receives this package with some thing. She doesn't know what the fuck it is. And she's freaking out and she's calling, she's like, I think it's a bomb, I think it's a bomb. And they come and it's like the part that they ordered to fix their washing machine or something like that. And it's something her husband deals with.
Oh, and
he wasn't home. So she's like crying of laughter and like recording this. And she's like, look at this thing. What do you think this looks like?
That's great.
And I was like, it does look like a bomb.
Right.
I have one.
Yay.
Called. It's by Sarah Cascone in
what
Art
is your
World.
Article named?
ArtNet News. A 12-year-old boy found an ancient woolly mammoth tooth during a vacation in Ohio.
Good for you,
I
son.
Mean, what
good
the hell?
For you.
I want to find.
Some people have all the
luck. Do you
think
he got paid?
No.
What? I'd want to sell it. I'd be like, 10 grand or no deal.
I'm pretty sure it's illegal to sell something like that.
You're probably right. But I guess. Oh, my computer just died.
Oh, no.
Anyway.
Oh, my God.
That's pretty cool. I don't know what they did with it. I'm so sorry.
Do you
so
want me to tell you? Because I also read
yes,
the article.
Yes, please. Say,
okay,
finish
I slightly
it.
Remember. So he was really excited. If I recall correctly, his dad and maybe his uncle are, like, really into archaeology and stuff. And, yeah, he was going to show all his friends.
Nice.
And they think he's really cool.
That's a great flex.
Which makes me think he's a nerd, which is good. And, yeah. And then they said that they were going to maybe look, you know, some. They showed it to some professors and stuff from, you know, nearby universities. And the place where they found it was saying they would love to put it on display at some point if the little boy is done with showing all his friends. Good story. Good shit in the news. Good shit. Oh, and I tweeted my story. So if that you want to go on like, my Twitter, you can see that story.
That sounds like something that would come out of your butt.
Tweeter?
I tweetered today. That's what that sounds like.
Is that a weird shit? Is that a good joke? No?
That
too
tweeter
gross?
Tweeter is the weird shit?
Yeah.
No, actually, that makes sense.
Oh, okay, good.
You have a poop you don't understand? Yeah, dude, I tweetered today.
It was a tweeter. I don't get it.
I think it's time to end the episode.
It is. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Thank you guys so much. Happy Wednesday.
Still technically Wednesday.
It is Wednesday. And, yeah, follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and
Instagram,
on Insta.
All the stuff. Okay, bye.
Goodbye. Oh, I forgot about mine.